When did God show the full extent of his love? When did God show the full extent of his love? Since this past December, we've been in a sermon series called A Year with Jesus. And we've been in this series where we're honestly, our leaders just said, what I think our church needs more than anything for this whole next year is just to look at Jesus. Ask, what did Jesus do? What did he teach? What did he accomplish? And hopefully in studying the life of Jesus, we can become more like Jesus. And so this past December, we began and we've gone through the birth narratives. We've gone through a lot of the miracles. We've been going through the teachings. And a couple of weeks ago, we began a new sub-series. Because if you've been following with us, we are now into the final week of Jesus' life. And 2 weeks ago, this series began called With Everything. A series that's asking the question, what does the Lord teach us about worship? In the final week of his life, what does the Lord teach us about worship? What does he tell us about who it is that we are to worship? What does he tell us about what is acceptable worship? How do we worship God in the way in which he desires, in the way in which he exemplifies for us? So 2 weeks ago, Bryce asked us the question, who is Jesus? Because ultimately, your expectations of Jesus, what you think he is, will affect your allegiance, and it will affect how you worship. And then last week, Bryce asked the question, what is acceptable worship? What is unacceptable worship? And he showed us from the word that God says unacceptable worship occurs when your heart is not in line with God's heart. And so today we're going to ask another question. Now, on the surface, this question may not seem to have anything to do with worship at all. You might be going, are you trying to start a sub-series within the sub-series for the overall series? No, I'm not. I'm really not. It's a question that initially honestly, even the text for today, you may be going, well, that's not a worship text. But let me go ahead and just tell you what the question is anyway. When did God show the full extent of his love? When did God show the full extent of his love? See, I told you. The question you're going, I could force that into a worship sermon. And maybe that's what some of you are even thinking I'm doing right now. It's like, you know, I've got this other sermon I want to preach, and then we're in a worship series, but this will fit anyway. And my only justification for really making the sermon fit is I was like, well, if they're not going to think it's a part of the worship series, maybe if I get the worship leader to preach with me, then everybody will be okay. Surely the sermon has something to do with worship if the worship leader's up here. Well, kind of. I know you may not recognize him, because you're used to seeing him, you know, behind a microphone or with a guitar. And I know that some of you may be thinking, what's his name again? Is it Tigger or David Crowder or that bearded guy? No, this is Josh Huckabee, our worship minister here at College Heights Christian Church. Hi, Josh. How are you, friend?
Good.
Good. Honestly, in all seriousness, no. I am so thankful that Josh leads my family and I every week in worship. And honestly, it's not just because I like hearing him sing, even though I do. I mean, it's not even because I think that he makes good music, because I think he does. But I love that Josh leads my family in worship every week, because his heart and mind have such a depth, a well that is so deep, that honestly, when you're around Josh, you can feel the blood of Christ overflowing onto you. And so I'm truly thankful to be able to have Josh share that heart with you, because honestly, his heart on stage pales in comparison to his heart even off the stage. And you need to hear that heart this morning. Josh?
Well, thank you, Shane. That was very nice of you. Nice compliments from a friend.
Oh, tears.
Okay. I won't tell them the names that people call you.
Story of my life,
see,
friend.
I work at the church, and so I read the emails and the comments, hippie, different homeless, things like that. Yeah, homeless person, yeah. Perhaps. I don't know. Totally kidding.
I'm just the disciple of Dave Marin's.
That's right.
Right, Dave? Solidarity, brother, solidarity.
That's awesome. Well, it seems like a simple enough question, doesn't it? When does God show the full extent of his love? I think there's probably a lot of answers to that question, probably a lot of answers even formulating in your own minds this morning about what the answer to that question is. But for the sake of starting, let's just begin in the beginning. How about creation? I mean, I don't know about you, but when I got to work this morning and as I'm looking around, even in the midst of the fog, I can see the handiwork of God. I can see his gift to us. I can see his love for us in creating something that's so beautiful. And I love that about Joplin, you know. You wouldn't think it, but Joplin has some of the most beautiful sunsets I've ever seen. You would kind of want some mountains and maybe an ocean in there somewhere. But we'll take what we can get, right?
Chat piles.
Yes, chat piles.
Those are our mountains.
Looking over the distance, across the chat piles, I saw the most beautiful sunset. Okay, we'll stop there. You know, the thing that I love is that we're not the only ones to acknowledge that this creation is a gift of God's love. In fact, David in Psalm 8 writes, "O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth." He says, "When I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you set in place, I think, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you should care for him? You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You've given him dominion over the works of your hands, and you've set everything under his feet." You might think, well, how is creation a gift to us? I mean, it exists for God's glory, of course, but I do think that it is a gift of his love. And I think one of the ways that it is in that phrase, dominion. He's given us dominion. You can almost picture God creating all these things, and he begins to call them good, the sun and the trees and the birds of the air and the fish in the ocean. He calls them all good, and he's getting so excited because he knows the pinnacle of that creation is coming, and man and woman. And he starts to say, "Oh, look, it's going to be really good. It's going to be really, really good." And you can almost kind of picture just like when you were a kid, right? And you had this special gift, the Hello Kitty page that you scribbled on. You're preparing it for your mom and dad as this wonderful gift. And you're like, you just can't hold the anticipation. And you're like, "I know this is going to be so good. I just can't wait to see their face when they get it." And I just see God doing the same thing. He's saying, "Here's this wonderful gift of dominion that he gives to Adam, and he lets him name the animals." I also think it's a gift because it's incredibly intricate. Did you know that there are some scientists that say there are over 90 different parameters in the universe, that if you change them slightly, the universe would no longer be able to sustain life, complex life, like we know it. It's almost this picture of this master craftsman who wants to be able to tell the person who's receiving this gift that this gift of love, it's got his fingerprint on it. It's got his mark on it. He pours himself into it. He knows it, and it's his work of art. It's his gift of love. Creation is a gift of God's love, and clearly it's an act of his love. But strangely, though, incredibly, though, the Bible never calls creation the full extent of God's love. That's reserved for something else.
When did God show the full extent of his love? I mean, there are many options that we could put out on the table and just discuss. And creation, honestly, is a good one, because it clearly is an act of God's love. But that is not the phrase that God uses throughout the Bible to talk about the full extent of his love. It's not the action of creation. So let's throw out another option. Maybe the incarnation is where God shows the full extent of his love. I think that's a pretty good option. I mean, I don't know about you, but whenever I'm meditating on the fact that God, the Word, became flesh, and dwelt among us. It can even be overwhelming just to even try to put that into words. More or less, even just reading the words that Paul himself used when he was reflecting on this very amazing act of love in Philippians 2. For Paul says that Jesus Christ, who being in the very nature God, did not consider his equality with God something to be grasped. But instead, he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. When I think of the incarnation, I definitely think of an act of love, and sometimes that can be overlooked. When it comes to the incarnation, a lot of times the debates surround around the virgin birth, or they surround around the perpetual virginity of Mary, or how much of Jesus was man and how much of Jesus was God. And what can be missed in all of these debates is that the incarnation is an incredible act of love. That God did not hold on to his positions of power and sovereignty, but he became the creation in order to save the creation from itself. That is love. An incredible act of love. And yet, the Bible never uses the phrase, the full extent of God's love, in reference to the incarnation. That title is reserved for another action.
So I can see the confusion on your faces. I can see the wheels turning in there. You're like, okay, well, we've kind of walked through it here. I guess it's not creation. I guess it's not the incarnation. So what could it be? Oh, I know. The cross, right? The cross? Oh, the cross. The cross. Yep. That's a good one.
It's a Sunday school answer.
Oh,
Jesus.
Jesus.
Oh.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
How
everybody's
could you be
singing
wrong?
That. Exactly.
How
here's a Tootsie you? Roll.
Tootsie Rolls.
You know, the cross is, man, what an act of love. I love how Paul tells us the cross has literally just changed everything in the universe. Mm. He says in Colossians 1:19 through 20, he says, for the fullness, for in him, God was have all of his fullness to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, things in heaven and things on earth, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. I'm not even sure I understand all the implications of that, but basically what he just said is that before the cross, the universe functioned, and our ability to function within that universe and within these two spaces, heaven and earth, was totally different than it is now after the cross. We have a completely different way of interacting with God now that Jesus has taken himself and been crucified on the cross. Mm. We can actually now pray, like Jesus told us to, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That can actually happen now, because the chasm that existed before has been brought together in him. We are now joined to heaven. If we call him our Lord, if he is our master, if he is our king, we are joined together with heaven, the space of heaven, and all that is there, the power. And how? Why? Because of the sacrifice of Jesus. That's like an act of love, right? I mean, John says this in John 15. Jesus says this, greater love has no man than this, and he lay his life down for his friends. And we weren't even deserving of it. He did it in spite of our complete deterioration. Paul says, Romans 5, but God demonstrates his love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And then John again, in 1 John 3:16, this is how we even know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. John tells the Ephesian church, you don't even get love until you understand Christ's sacrifice. You don't get it. We are now adopted sons and daughters of God into his family. There are no orphans in God's family. We are now friends of God. You're telling me that the cross made it somehow possible that the creator of all of the universe actually stepped into our world and saved us, and now I'm his friend? What? The star breather? Yeah, right. We're called co-heirs with Christ. You know what an heir does? Sits on a throne. We're called new creations. I don't get it. It's an incredible act of love. But strangely enough, this is not the act that the Bible calls the full extent of God's love. We're still holding out for something else.
When does God show the full extent of his love? Now, I want to be very clear that you hear what we're saying, because it's always good to make sure we're on the same page. We are not saying that creation wasn't an act of love, because it clearly is. And we're not saying that the incarnation was not an act of love, because it clearly is. And we are not saying, God help us, that the cross of Jesus Christ is not an act of love, because it clearly is. But what astounded Josh and I is to come to find out that one time in the entire Bible, one time in the Word of God, does it ever use the phrase, the full extent of God's love? And it wasn't attached to any of these three options. There's only one time where we find the phrase, the full extent of God's love. And it's found in John chapter 13, verse 1. That's the text, so you can go ahead and turn there. John chapter 13, verse 1. This is after the triumphal entry. This is after Jesus has entered Jerusalem. After the shouts from the crowds have ceased. This is when Jesus and his disciples sit down and they say, we need to have a meal. In John 13, verse 1, the text says this. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, listen to this. He now showed them the full extent of his love. He now showed them the full extent of his love. You see, Jesus knew this would be one of the final times where all of his disciples were gathered into one place. And he wanted them to hold on to something that would echo in their ears, that would resound in their hearts, that would form them for the generations to come. He wanted them to grab onto a concept that is beyond what words can accomplish, and that is the full extent of his love. He could have chosen a miracle, but miracles can be misunderstood because sometimes we get more enamored with the method than we do the message. I mean, he could have chosen another teaching opportunity, but sometimes we can miss the message and be focused too much on the delivery of the messenger. Or Jesus could have in this moment pointed them to the cross, but even the cross can be misunderstood. People look at the cross, sometimes they say, well, that's just the result of a betrayer. Or maybe just the flat out, they just tell the truth and say, the cross is foolishness. And the message of the cross can get lost. Instead of a miracle, instead of a teaching, instead of the cross, Jesus shows the full extent of his love by grabbing a towel and a basin. Now, there are three details as this story develops that allows us to understand the impact of what is happening here, that changes this story from just a good little, narrative, a good little story, into one of the more foolish acts of love that we see in the entire life of Jesus. The first detail that we get comes in verse 2. It says, the evening meal was being served. And listen to this. And the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Notice how the whole story begins. John starts the meal. Instead of diving into what they're serving, he says, let me make sure you understand the setting. Judas has already accepted the mission from Satan. He's already accepted the pursuit of finding a way to betray Jesus to hand him over. Matter of fact, Luke chapter 22, verse 3, says that Satan had already entered Judas before this meal. That's the first detail, but it's a little bit deeper than that. Judas had not only agreed to this, but Jesus knows he has. If you look down in verse 10, after Peter's like, oh, don't wash my feet. And Jesus is like, I have to. And he's like, well, then wash my whole body. You know, it's like, oh, Peter, calm down. Like, good grief. Jesus says this to him in verse 10. He says, a person who has had a bath and needs only to wash his feet. Relax, Peter. His whole body is clean. And Peter, you are clean. But he says this, though not every one of you is clean. And if you don't know what Jesus is referring to, read verse 11. He says, for Jesus knew who was going to betray him. He knew who was going to betray him. And that was why he said not everyone was clean. The first detail that John puts in front of our face at the beginning of this narrative is Judas has already agreed to betray Jesus, and Jesus knows it. The second detail comes in the only other name besides Judas and Jesus to even appear in this whole narrative. The rest of the disciples are there, but they're never mentioned by name. The only other person mentioned by name is Peter. You know, Peter, who in about a dozen or so verses will say, Jesus, I will lay down my life for you. And then in chapter 18, verse 10, he tries to deliver on that commitment by taking a sword and striking the ear of Malchus, the priest, the high priest's servant. And then in chapter 18, verse 27, remember Peter, who to the face of a little girl denies Jesus three times because he's trying to preserve himself. You know, Peter. We get two details so far. First one is Judas has already been prompted at this meal to betray Jesus, and Jesus knows it. The only other person mentioned in this narrative is the one that will abandon Jesus to preserve himself after saying he would lay his life down for him. And here comes detail number three. This is the part that really makes this moment explosive. In chapter 13, verse 3, it says this. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. Jesus knew that he held all of the power in his hands. He knew that nothing that was about to happen was outside of his control. He knew that he had the power. Now let's put all these details together. In this scene, Jesus stares the face of the one that will abandon and deny him square in the eyes. He stares into the face of the betrayer. He stares into the face of maybe even Satan himself. And in this moment, Jesus has all the power to destroy them. He has all the power to bring about revenge and retribution even before the actions happen. And in this moment, Jesus washes their feet. He washes their feet. The full extent of God's love in John 13 is when Jesus stares evil in the eye and having all the power to destroy them, instead of reaching for a sword, he reaches for a towel and a basin. An act like this is not only insane, but it's the only act in the Bible that's called the full extent of God's love.
So we want you to hear again what we're not saying. We're not trying to denigrate the cross. Stop the Facebook messaging. Stop the tweeting.
No tweeting, please.
We're not trying to denigrate the cross. The cross, it isn't. Definitely an act of God's love, an action of God's love, so much, so huge of an act. But the cross is something that's done to Jesus. He chooses it. Don't get me wrong. He chooses it. But it's something that's done to him. John 13, however, is what happens when you get the impetus, when you have the motivation, when you have the love of the cross done to other people by Jesus. You see what we're saying? When the love of the cross is shown in a normal, everyday, basic activity, the washing of dirty feet is what you get. Looking your eye, looking your betrayer in the eyes and washing his feet, that's what you get. Staring Satan in the face, knowing his evil and bowing before him and serving him, that's what you get. We're not trying to denigrate the cross. We're actually elevating it. For it's the same love that leads Christ to the cross that gives him the resolve to wash the dirty feet. So probably the thing that you're wondering right now is, so Shane and Josh, what does this have to do with worship?
Yes.
Please tell me.
Tell me, please.
Tell me, Lord. I think the answer is given to us in John 13, in the text. This is what he says. Jesus said, "Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done to you." This is what he's saying. He's saying, guys, you've encountered me. You've seen my heart. So do the same things that I do. If you claim to know me, if you claim to worship me, then do the same things that I do. It's not just about knowing who he is. He is the king. It's not just about knowing what's acceptable or unacceptable. It's about having the same heart as God. That's what Jesus is trying to teach his disciples. It's about having the exact same heart. Jesus was a worshiper, and you should be too. He was constantly finding himself going back to the presence of his Father. How do you think Jesus had all that love wrapped up inside of him? Well, he had the Father's heart. How do you get the Father's heart? Well, you spend time with him. How do you become like any other person that you know? How do we model anybody else that we know in our lives? Well, you have to spend time with them. You don't just talk about them. You actually live with them. And that's exactly what Jesus is calling us to do. That's how we do the same kinds of things that he does. But the problem is twofold. For some of us, the problem is you just don't worship. You actually think that coming to this building right here and sitting together with the saints for an hour and 15 minutes every day is enough to give you the Father's heart. Wrong. Incorrect. That is not correct. How many days are in a week? How many hours are in a week? How many days are in a month? How many days are in a year? You're going to tell me that 52 days is enough to give you the Father's heart and for people to see it around you? I don't think so. I don't think so. Some of you actually just need to worship. You need to go to the quiet places. You need to rest in solitude. You need to listen to the Lord. You need to hear him. He's calling out to you. Because you become and you are what you worship. So whatever you worship, whether it's your job, because that's all you do, or watching television, or not that those things are bad in themselves, you will become what you worship. I guarantee you. If you don't spend time in the presence of God, you will not be able to overcome evil with good like Christ did. You will not be able to do it. The second problem is this. Some of you think that you worship and you actually don't. There's two dimensions to worship. You realize this. The first dimension is the vertical dimension. Most of us are really good at the vertical dimension. Oh God, I love you so much. You're so awesome. Thank you so much for all you did for me. But there's also another dimension, and that's this one. That's the one that affects my brother or my sister or the people who Jesus has found in or the people who Jesus wants me to go to. And the problem is, if you don't have both dimensions of worship, you haven't worshiped at all. If you come in here every single week and you sing your praises to God, you let your tongue just rip off the best prayers, but you don't use that, the love of the Father, to treat your families well, to lead your families, husbands, to love your children, wives. If you don't do that, you have not worshiped. You have not worshiped. All you have done is committed idolatry. So you have worshiped something, but what it is either a singer on this stage, it's either a song that somebody wrote, it's either an emotion that was conjured up inside of you, or it was an experience that you came longing for in the first place. But you have not worshiped God, because when you worship God, He will send you out in His power to do His work and His acts of love. He will send you to wash the feet of your enemy. He will send you to forgive your betrayer. And He's tired, church. He's tired of it. Shame on us when we come into this place. We sing His praises with our lips, but our hands don't move. Our feet don't go. Shame on us. I love that picture. I love that picture in the Chronicles of Narnia, in the magician's nephew, where Aslan, walking in the vastness, the expanse of the universe, begins to sing. And he sings, and as he sings, things begin to be created. All kinds of things, stars, creatures, everything you could imagine, they begin to sing. That's what the universe was made to do. I love this line. He writes this. Then two wonders happened at the same moment. One was that the voice, Aslan's voice, was suddenly joined by all the other voices. More voices than you could possibly count. They were in harmony with it, but far higher up the scale. Cold, tingling, silvery voices. Scientists actually think now that the universe was created with sound waves. You can just see this picture of God singing. I guess C.S. Lewis wasn't too far off. It was made to sing. It was made to sing and to echo back the song of love that it was first created with. Don't believe me? Look at this picture. This is the Vela Pulsar. And it's been singing like this. We retrieve that with our nice falutin technology. The universe is singing. Look at this next picture. This is a globular cluster, 47 Tuck. I guess they're tuning right now. The universe is singing. It's echoing back the song of love because that's what it was made to do. And guess what? We were made to sing, not just with our lips, but with our lives. We were made to sing with our lives. So I guess the question becomes, what song is your life singing? Or have you even heard God's song at all?
We need to stop just singing with our voices and to start singing with our lives. And that's what John 13 is all about. And that's where that question of when does God show the full extent of his love intersect with the heartbeat of worship. Because worship is not done just with a guitar or just with a piano or just with a microphone. Worship is us imitating God in every aspect of our life. Whether that is you, the way in which you talk to your wife, or the way in which you talk to your children, or the way in which you talk to the ones that have cheated you, or the ways in which you've talked to the ones that falsely accuse you, or the people that slander you, or even the least of these, the way we treat those with no homes, or with no clothes, or with no food, worship is imitating God in every aspect of your life. It is reflecting the image of God that we were created in. Back to the one that revealed the image in Jesus Christ with the towel and with the basin. Worship is about being known for the things that Christ was known for. John ends this passage with Jesus saying these powerful words. In verses 16 and 17, Jesus says, I've shown you what to do. Now go do it. And then he asks this simple question. He says, is a servant greater than his master? The answer is no. For what the master does, the servant can expect to do too. Because no servant is greater than his master. We need to sing with not just our voices, but with our lives.
So we're going to respond this morning, and we are going to sing, but hopefully our song doesn't stop when we leave this room today. There's going to be leaders at the front today, and I think there's two different things that we're asking you to respond in. For some of you, you actually think that you can have the Father's heart by worshiping him an hour and 15 minutes every week. You think that you can actually be transformed into the likeness of God, into the image of God, in such a short amount of time. And it's foolish. And he wants more. He wants all. And some of you, there's just been some falsity that's come out of your mouth toward God and toward your neighbor. You know, James, the brother of Jesus, says, I don't understand how you can praise God with your mouth, with your tongue, in one instance, and then the next instance you can curse your brother. How can cursing and praising come out of the same mouth? The answer is they can't. The answer is they shouldn't. And you need to actually figure out what it is that worship means. You need to stop leaving this room after having praised him from your lips and using those same lips to be critical of your spouses, of your children, of your coworkers, and your hearts filled with hatred. Your life's filled with apathy towards the things of God that he cares about deeply. So we're asking you to come. And we're asking you to sing, but not just right now. We're asking you to sing with everything, forever. Let's join in with the universe, church. It's singing right now. Let's join in. Thank you.